Midstream.
In the aftermath of the Beirut Tayuni massacre of October 14th, Lebanese forces militia leader Samir Jaja was summoned by Lebanon's military court for questioning over a shooting attack on a peaceful demonstration, resulting in the martyrdom of six protesters and one mother of five inside her own house. The summon follows incriminating confessions given by some of the arrested Lebanese forces members, which took the investigation file into the Tayuni massacre to a whole new level. This development is a serious indication that there is an intention by the Intelligence Directorate to expand the investigation beyond the moment of the outbreak of armed clashes and its aftermath. Intel information revealed that during the interrogation of a number of suspects belonging to the Lebanese forces militia in the Tayuni massacre, testimonies confirmed information that was already in possession of the security services about armed groups affiliated with the Lebanese forces, which usually do not make a move except with the knowledge of party leader Samir Jaja and with direct orders from him. The movements of these groups were recorded the night before the events of Tayuni in both Ain al-Rimani and Ashrafieh stronghold areas for Jaja thugs in Beirut. The investigators considered that the detainees' statements led to the suspicion of a pre-planned scheme, which began to be implemented the night before the Tayuni ambush. The Directorate of Intelligence and the Military Public Prosecution supervising the investigation put the detainees' statements and the available information in the context of the TV interview that Jaja conducted after the Tayuni incident, in addition to his previous statements, in which an adoption of responsibility was clear on behalf of Jaja concerning the Tayuni attack. Based on this data, Lebanese military court judge Fadi Aqiqi asked the Intelligence Directorate to summon Jaja to the investigation to hear his testimony. What was warlord Jaja's reaction to the court summoning? The convicted felon simply refused to appear before the military court over the Tayuni clashes if Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah is not also summoned. I kid you not, this is what he actually said. The man just ignored the fact that the Directorate of Intelligence was moving according to confessions and testimonies made by the suspects in its custody, which intersected with information contained in security reports about the movement of armed groups from Jaja's headquarters in Ma'rab to Beirut on the same night of the incident. To up the ante against Jaja's lame position, it was even indicated by eyewitnesses in the area where the first sniper shot was fired that they were surprised that morning by young men from the Lebanese forces wearing black t-shirts bearing the image of a crossed-out cross dispersed in the inner streets of Ain al-Rimani. The real endgame of the Lebanese forces is to ignite civil war that would lead to demographic change. This is what the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, concluded after the Tayuni ambush. But apparently, it was game over for Jaja before it had even started. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Prominent development was recorded last week in Beirut in the investigation file into the Tayuni massacre, with the decision of the government commissioner to the military court, Judge Fadi Aie, to summon the head of the Lebanese forces militia, Samir Jaja, against the background of investigations conducted by the Intelligence Directorate. This indicates a real intention of the Lebanese security apparatus to delve into the available data regarding the night before the clashes, after information was available indicating that there was an intent to prepare for a confrontation, or at least to draw the resistance camp into an armed clash. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is retired Army General Elias Farhat. Thank you very much for being with us, General. Now, the military court has summoned Lebanese forces militia leader Samir Jaja at the backdrop of the testimonies over the deadly clashes in Al Tayuni massacre in the light of the confessions of many of the detainees in custody of the authorities in Lebanon. Now, we have conflicting reports concerning whether he will attend or not. And this week, we had new developments concerning summoning him to the Ministry of Defense in the Yerzeh of Lebanon. If he does not attend, will it actually backfire on him? Does he have an option not to attend?
First of all, things have changed today, definitely in the afternoon, when websites published a written subpoena by the Lebanese Army Intelligence calling Samir Jaja to come to Yerzeh, to the Director of Intelligence, which was different from what was circulated before, that the government commissioner, the military court, summoned him to the military court. Now things changed. He will undergo an investigation in the military intelligence, which is something different. And Samir Jaja himself had an experience with this intelligence in the 90s, when they arrested him for and was convicted and stayed about 11 years in that jail. So now it's different. Now, whether Samir Jaja will attend or not, that depends upon the his calculations, exactly the political calculations. Really, he was surprised by the summon of the government commissioner in the military court, and this surprise embarrassed him. So he didn't make his mind yet to whether will appear or not before the intelligence investigator. If he did appear, that means he will give in to the military intelligence, and that will cancel all his proud and all his prejudicial words against the intelligence and other services. And
but General, in case he decides not to show up,
yes,
to Yerzeh, what will happen?
If he did not appear and make his decision not to appear before the military intelligence, then legally speaking, the commissioner has right to refer him to the magistrate, and the magistrate will may arrest him in absent, which means that he will be wanted for all the law enforcement posts all over the country and the crossing borders.
What you are talking about is definitely something new, a new development, a risky one for the entire country, but somewhat a fair one for the people that fell in the Tayuni massacre. But we have intel information from the Lebanese army that revealed that during the interrogation of a number of the detainees belonging to the Lebanese forces militia about the Tayuni massacre, their testimonies confirmed the information that we spoke about earlier concerning pre-planned schemes and having armed groups affiliated with Jaja brought into Beirut from Ma'rab, from Ashrafieh, from Kisirwen, or from other areas with direct orders from Samir Jaja himself. If that is proving to be true, will Jaja be convicted of a terror attack? And if so, what would his sentence be?
Yes, this was published in the media, and people talk about the snipers and the units from the Lebanese forces who came before, and the coordination between the organizers of the march towards the Palace of Justice and the intelligence officers in Tayuni, both from the army and from the internal security forces. They also said that there were some people who came from outside Ain al-Rumaini and went to some stories high stories in the region and shoot at the march of the people and cause the casualties. I think now we are in front of a judicial operation, mm-hmm. where this summoning was all under the incriminating confessions of the detainees, who determined the directly that the people, the armed people who shot fire at the demonstrators, were units from Marab, the headquarters of Dr. Samir Shaja. This evidences or this these testimonies enabled the commissioner, the government commissioner in the military court, to appoint Samir Shaja personally, mm-hmm. to the Yerzi head.
Samir Shaja was very frank and crystal clear in the last interview that he had, and he had a condition. He said, I'm okay with that. I would go only if the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, is also summoned. We're talking about 7 civilians who fell as martyrs as a result of Shaja's personal involvement in this. Is there legal ground for the military court to summon the Secretary General of Hezbollah?
His appearance before the military intelligence or before the court is the testimonies and to try to include Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah in this case is nonsense, because Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah is a party commander, and you know he does not seem. And even if some people that support Hezbollah were heard or seen in the area carrying weapons after they evacuated the killed people and the injured, that means they came by themselves as a reaction and not as a plan which the intelligence of the army and the internal security forces are fully aware that the armed elements of the Lebanese forces who were in the other side in Ain al-Rubani shoot at the people. That's something different. Is to combine himself with Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah is something strange.
So there is no legal ground
nobody
for
buy
that.
It.
There is no legal ground for what Samir Shaja was saying. Yeah. Unfortunately, we're out of time here. I want to thank you very much, retired Army General Mr. Elias Farhat, for joining us to talk about this very huge development in Lebanon. We're going to see how this role will go throughout the week and next week in Lebanon as well. Thank you very much for joining us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking at a different development out in the Syrian desert.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, although the attack carried out by the Axis of Resistance Forces in Syria on the American base of Al-Tanf is linked to the recent Israeli raids that targeted an overnight camp in the Homs desert about 10 days ago, it is not possible to separate this attack from the new strategy that is taking path to uproot the American occupation forces from Syria through both political and military pressure. The latest attack, which appears to have been carried out by the Syrian Allies Operations Room, which includes several factions in response to the Israeli-American raids that targeted one of its sites near Palmyra, was very precise, as the drones penetrated the 55-kilometer-long fortified area, reaching the base and successfully carrying out its mission. Explosions rock Al-Tanf base in this following report.
forces of Syria's allies carried out their promise to respond to the joint Israeli-American aggression that targeted positions occupied by the former's forces near the city of Palmyra in the eastern countryside of Homs about 10 days ago, which led to a number of martyrs and wounded. On Thursday, October 21st, Syria's allies carried out their threat as bomber drones targeted the residence of American occupation soldiers, in addition to a kitchen and food warehouse inside the Atenf base, located on the border triangle between Syria, Iraq, and Jordan. The retaliatory attack came in conjunction with missiles targeting the base and its surroundings, which led to several explosions igniting a fire inside the base. So far, we have not been able to determine the extent of the casualties. But what we know is that the explosions and fire were followed by heavy flight of American helicopters. Meanwhile, the Pentagon did confirm the targeting of its troops base in Atenf, noting that no casualties among the American forces was recorded. What was remarkable about Thursday's retaliatory attack on the American occupation base is that it did not come in response to a traditional Israeli aggression. On the day following the operation, the leadership of the Syria Allies Operations Room issued a statement confirming that it had taken a decision to respond harshly to the aggression on Palmyra. In parallel with a statement that vowed to respond, the leadership of the Allied Forces of Resistance in Syria issued instructions to its forces to implement a wide deployment plan in preparation for an escalation that may follow the inevitable response to the aggression. The U.S. occupation's choice to reside in the Atenf region in the Syrian desert was not arbitrary, but came after a careful study of the map of the region, where the base is located on a border triangle overlooking Iraq and Jordan on one side and the Syrian depth on the other. Also, the base is located on the shortest road linking Damascus with Baghdad and then Tehran, which enables Washington to achieve a set of goals. Whether it is supervising the region and the ability it provides for rapid movement, or being stationed at a point that can be considered a stumbling block for Iran, which the United States considers of most importance. The Atenf attack embedded a set of messages, most notably the ability that the resistance forces possess to break American fortifications, in addition to confirming the continuation of the pressing military confrontation, especially since these attacks were preceded by other similar attacks against American forces' positions in northeastern Syria. Most notably, the attack on the Al Umar oil field, which Washington controls in the areas of deployment of the Kurdish separatist forces near Deir ez-Zor last July. This last operation also paves the way for the next stage of confrontation with the Israeli entity, with a direct message that any other Israeli aggression will be met with response, regardless of the areas from which they were launched, even if they are the areas where American occupation forces are deployed.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Damascus is author and academic and Australian coordinator of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance, Dr. Tim Anderson. Thank you very much for being with us, Tim. The attack against a U.S. occupation base in the Syrian desert in the Atenf area carried a set of messages, most notably the ability that these resistance forces possess to actually break American fortifications in the heart of Syria. It's a triangle that is very, very effective towards targeting the inner part of Syria. Are such attacks inside Syria left for retaliatory defensive measures by this Friends of Syria group against these U.S. forces, or have this now shifted into a complete new strategy against the occupation?
I think it's still defensive strategy by and large. There's a huge amount of resentment at the occupation in eastern Syria, and let's remember that the attacks on Syrian forces are co-coordinated with Qassad, with the Kurdish separatists in the northeast and the east. That is to say, they have been transporting Daesh operatives from their prisons, from various parts of the northeast, down to towards Deir ez-Zor and towards Al-Tanf. So there is a great coordination between the occupation in the southern border and all along the eastern border with Iraq.
Well, the recent military escalation coincided with both political and military moves on several domains, including the continuous Russian and Turkish pressures to remove American forces from Syria, as Ankara, it's a bit funny for me, but Ankara considers the Americans presence as an occupation and only there to protect what they say, the Kurdish forces, at a time when Russia considers this presence an obstacle to a comprehensive political solution for the global war on Syria, and Syria definitely agrees with the latter logic. So the majority of all sides taking part in the conflict agree with the necessity to remove the American occupation from Syria. Is that enough, though, for the Biden administration to actually just pick up its stuff and go back home?
No, of course, and the words don't really match the actions, do they? In fact, some of the Security Council resolutions in recent years have been fairly good in words in terms of the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Syria, the Syrian-led process, and so on. But, of course, neither Erdogan nor the U.S. have been applying those in reality, and they've both been continuing to support their own proxies to try and keep Syria divided and weak and destabilized, basically. So there is, of course, a process going on now, as I understand, that the U.S. is talking to the Russians, and the separatist Kurds are talking to the Russians and to the Europeans and trying to figure out which way to jump when the U.S. pulls out. I think it's a foregone conclusion the U.S. is going to pull out, but they are looking for the conditions to save face and to try and maintain some of the destabilization they've managed with the various proxy groups that they are still controlling.
Well, part of the proxy groups that you're talking about that the Americans actually control are the Kurdish separatists to the north and the northeast, and also we have this new Maghawir al-Thawra, which is, I mean, the name by itself, with Wahhabis being their part of that name, is just funny for me. But which of these mercenaries are more likely to stick with what the U.S. wants rather than just drop the U.S. like a hot potato, just like the U.S. has always been dropping them all like a hot potato?
Yes, well, there is a different character with the Wahhabi Takfiri groups, isn't there, to the separatist Kurds. The separatist Kurds initially were armed against Daesh by the Syrian government, and so there has not been serious confrontation between the Syrian army and the Kurdish separatists up until now. But they're very weak, they're fragmented, they entirely depend on the U.S. occupation. They are having a great corrosive impact on security and food security and damaging education and health in that region. But they are not of the same character as Daesh. Now, you see, when the U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan, they've left behind a present to the Afghan people of Daesh K to destabilize and cause problems for the Afghan people. And I think there's every reason to believe they're going to try and maintain that in Syria. But nevertheless, they're looking for a withdrawal from Syria that doesn't allow the whole Qasad separatist Kurdi to collapse. But that's a huge challenge because it seems...
Well, Tim, you had quite a journey in the past couple of weeks that I really want to hear about. You've been on a tour in the northern part of Syria, liberated area, especially after all the havoc that they had to endure in areas that were stricken hard by the war. What can you tell us about the community there, especially in the northern part of the country, especially at a time when the unilateral American punitive measures against all Syrian people are really hitting hard?
Yes, well, it's interesting. For me, the most striking things were to see the very strong presence of the Syrian state in the northeast, in Hasakeh province, in the major cities of Qamishli and Hasakeh, for example. There is a strong presence of the army, of the public health system. Even the councils are still in place, although semi-dormant, basically. But most striking of all was the schools, that there's been a huge influx of students from all around the province into the Syrian syllabus schools, because the Kurdi school system effectively has collapsed. They've closed most of the schools, taken them over for other purposes. The ones that are running a syllabus that's not recognized anywhere. And so the most striking thing for me was to see thousands and thousands of young students flocking into the Syrian syllabus schools in Hasakeh City and then going out again, trying to avoid the Qasad checkpoints because they're being harassed there. But just to say that there's a huge vote by the families of the children in Hasakeh, a vote of confidence in the Syrian school system, and that's an extraordinary thing I didn't expect to see.
That's after 11 years of global war on Syria. This sounds a bit optimistic in this puddle of unsafety that Syria was living throughout the years. Thank you very much for your insights, Tim Anderson from Damascus, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Canada continues with its mostly racist policies towards its indigenous inhabitants. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Palestine Chronicle. This article is published under the heading Canadian Imperialism Back to the Future. Stay tuned for more. Canada was born of empire and still thrives within that milieu. It is the progeny of French and British imperial quest in the New World and is accompanied by its siblings within the Five Eyes, the most influential being the United States. Canada's creation out of mostly British imperial interest carried all the factors of imperialism internally as it developed across the North American continent. Currently, it still acts within the imperial prerogative, both domestically with its indigenous population and overseas with various other countries, frequently under the aegis of the U.S., but often enough acting on its own accord. Two incidents involved many aspects of contemporary concern, including racism, the environment, government police power, energy, native land rights. The latter, which is a very specific concern within British Columbia, as very little of the province's land has been ceded by the indigenous population. The damage done to indigenous life, to indigenous culture as a whole, and to the thousands of affected individuals and families is enormous and is still ongoing as survivors and their families, their whole nations, struggle with the after effects of the system. The term survivors indicates the brutal reality that thousands of indigenous children did not survive the residential school system, at the same time highlighting that the schools were a malignant imposition onto the culture of the people. The original white contacts in British Columbia were the fur traders who dealt with indigenous populations generally in a more restricted contact environment. The natives were considered astute traders, but nevertheless were still subject to white racism and British gunboat diplomacy. With the advent of white settlers, land settlement for resource exploitations, including minerals, forestry, fishing, and agriculture, effectively cleansed the indigenous populations of BC and the Prairie provinces of Canada from their territories. Regardless, the removal of the indigenous populations of BC and prairie provinces was accomplished through disease, including smallpox, tuberculosis mainly, and other ailments associated with European lifestyles, military, and settler violence, and the full range of laws and orders designed to maintain dominance and exclusion over the remaining populations. Those lands not dispossessed became the reserves, small plots of land of little importance for any of the resource industries. Canada's modern apartheid system that still exists and continues to subjugate the indigenous populations regardless of the rhetoric of reconciliation. Talk is important, but it is the land that is the culture. Canada continues with its mostly racist policies towards its indigenous inhabitants. The Indian Act, now incorporated into the Constitution, and limitations put on other laws and the control exerted by the Department of Indian Affairs denies the equality of rights to land and resources for the indigenous people. As above, violence is still used to control indigenous lands for resource extraction by large corporations. It is not surprising that this domestic policy is reflecting Canada's foreign policies. Often viewed as a peacemaker thanks to its own propaganda and the propaganda successes of Lester Pearson's UN efforts for a peacekeeping force, Canada's foreign interests are very frequently assisted under more violent terms. Right from the beginning, when Canada was essentially settled and the Indian problems had been removed either to the reservations or to the impoverished centers of major towns and cities, Canada's imperial role under British guidance continued. Canada has never lost the cultural ties to the British that promote imperial military adventurism overseas. Those links did weaken, but the neighborly presence of the United States and the increasing encroachment of U.S. affairs binding Canada to the U.S. have directed Canada, willingly for the most part, to support U.S. foreign policies. It is not always military activities binding the two countries. NATO, NAFTA, NORAD, and other agreements make Canada an effective part of the U.S. empire. Canada's contemporary foreign policy events highlight its attachments to the U.S. empire, but also its willingness to act on its own parallel interests. Canada supported NATO in its bombing of Serbia, the bombing of Libya, and its occupation of Afghanistan. It has recently organized the Lima Group, a collection of right-wing Latin American governments willing to harass and sanction Venezuela, while supporting a government in exile led by U.S. puppet Juan Guaido. Now that Lima has departed from the group, it has not been active in current events. Haiti is a prime example of Canadian imperial interference. Food was part of the program. In order to maintain the imperial legacy in Haiti, Canada played a major role in eliminating a native pig species, forcing the importation of hogs from Canada and the U.S. Canada supported the removal of tariffs on rice, allowing foreign rice, cheaply subsidized, to flood the market and devastate the local rice growers. Food dependency not being enough, Canada assisted in deposing the popularly elected Jean-Bertrand Aristide. In other affairs, Canada supports sanctions against Russia based mainly on U.S. and British foreign policy objectives. Only recently, Canada embroiled itself in U.S. foreign affairs by arresting and holding Meng Wanzhou of extradition to the U.S. on trumped-up bank and wire fraud charges. Meng was released after some backroom negotiations between Canada and the U.S., more than likely propelled by real politics than any generosity or humanitarian considerations. Not the last, and not least, but highly significant is Canada's support of the Israeli regime. While officially holding to the two-state solution, Canada does not care to understand willfully that the two-state solution is all but impossible. The willful ignorance continues with Canada's parliament passing an anti-BDS motion. In CJPME's chats with MPs after the vote, many MPs admitted they knew virtually nothing about the BDS movement and what motivates it. Fortunately, the Canadian populace is well ahead of the government with concerns about the illegality of the Zionist regime's settlement policies, its near-starvation rules placed on food imports to Gaza, and the ongoing violence and expulsions of Palestinians in the West Bank. Sounds familiar this far into the critique. A series of recent polls show that the majority of citizens support BDS movement and the application of international law and human rights in part through the jurisdiction of the ICC. Israeli activities in Sheikh Jarrah and the military actions against Gaza, while not highlighted in the mainstream media, were important factors in the general trend of the polls. Canada, born of empire, continues to be an active imperial participant, both in its own endeavors and in support of ongoing British and U.S. imperial adventures. Along with the British-sponsored outpost of the Israeli regime in the West Asia region, among all its other imperial concerns, Canada's imperial drive at home and abroad is as strong as ever.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
A new regionalism has taken form out of the multipolar world order with the characteristics of spontaneous movements grown out of international regions. As the world struggles to adjust to the transforming and globalizing trends, regional countries find it pragmatically essential to cooperate locally. In return, modern regionalism offers them a more comprehensive and multifaceted solution compared to regional integrations of the past. It goes far beyond the realms of free trade and economic development and addresses environmental, social, and security issues as well. The success of regionalism in Europe is a good testament for nations who are still hesitant about regional cooperation despite the existence of common economic, cultural, and geopolitical characteristics and a need for greater regional empowerment. In the economic sphere, new regionalism has been extremely effective in helping to secure markets and providing economic strength through the creation of regional trade agreements. In line with these transforming developments, the Islamic Republic of Iran has entered into a few regionalization processes itself. As part of this new strategy, It has put cooperation and convergence with the Eurasian Economic Union on its agenda. The EAEU bloc offers the Islamic Republic a combination of dependable trade, diplomacy, and counter-Western alignment that could be meaningful to Tehran in its international relations. In the past few years, and especially throughout the coronavirus pandemic, China has replaced Europe as the main trade partner of Iran. This has been one of the few positive experiences in the international arena for Iran in recent times. Building on this positive experience, Tehran has shaken up its economic diplomacy by looking north in addition to the east as a way to diversify its partnerships and regional cooperation. For a more in-depth look at Iran's new regional policies and its goals in cooperating with Russia in the framework of the Eurasian Economic Union, stay with us on this week's edition of Iran Today. The U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear agreement, or JCPOA, during Trump years and its extensive sanctions against Iran, in addition to Russia's geopolitical difficulties with the West, have led these two countries to expand their cooperation within the framework of the Eurasian Economic Union. So far, the results show that aside from the economic benefits of the agreement, its political and geopolitical goals are also of high significance for both Iran and Russia. Mr. Zangane is member of the Parliamentary Plan and Budget Committee and spokesperson for the Committee on a Production Leap. He's also a researcher, economist, and Allama University professor. Let's hear him out.
I think that if we focus our attention on Eastern countries, especially those in Central Asia, East Asia, as well as Eastern Europe, instead of focusing on the West, we can definitely benefit from their considerable economic potential. As you are aware, we are facing a lot of challenges in interacting with Western countries because of the United States and Israel's attitude toward Iran. But the same challenges don't exist in our ties with Eastern nations. That creates a great opportunity for our economy.
Iran is an important consumer market for the region, and the development of relations with this country is of high importance for the EAEU members. Given the ongoing illegal US and EU sanctions on Iran, its economy is now seeking the Eurasian markets to replace lost European trade and investment. Mr. Mohaqiq Nia is a specialist in economy. He'll be sharing his views with us.
Last year, while almost the entire world saw negative economic growth because of the coronavirus, China's economy grew by 9.8%. Considering how big China's economy already is, a country whose GDP is $14 trillion, a 10% economic growth is very significant. That makes China an emerging power. It needs countries like Iran to continue that growth. We also need to correct the unbalanced view toward the West and also look at the East. We can define a win-win situation which will ultimately benefit the people. That would be made possible only if we bring investors from the east to Iran.
The EAEU region is located at the eastern end of Europe, bounded by the Arctic in the north, the Pacific Ocean to the east, and Eastern Asia, West Asia, and parts of Central Asia to the south. This region accounts for about 15% of the world's land mass, 2.4% of the world's population, and 2.2% of the world's GDP. Mr. Modabbir is a specialist counselor on the Russian Federation and Eurasian Economic Union, as well as the Shanghai Security and Economic Organization. Let's hear him out.
The Eurasian Economic Union was an upgraded version of the Customs Union initiated by Russian President Vladimir Putin with the aim of breaking Western sanctions and restricting the unilateral pressure the US imposed on emerging and powerful nations. You know that the Russian Federation is also a member of the World Trade Organization, but because of the Americans' tendency to pressure emerging powers, such as the Russian Federation, the Russian side initiated the union with its allies. The Eurasian Economic Union has grown to the point where more than 40 countries are now in line to join.
The member states established the union based on a certain understanding of their long-term economic objectives, creating a single market for trading goods, services, and capital distribution of labor forces among member states, as well as the highly ambitious goal of creating a customs union.
One of the most important capacities and programs in the Eurasian Economic Union, which is exactly like the World Trade Organization, is the abolition of customs tariffs between its members and, most importantly, the investment program in the member states aimed at the coordination of the growth and development of the Eurasian Economic Union. We have a very important clause in the Union's documents called knowledge exchange. The member states can use this opportunity to exchange knowledge amongst themselves. They can also exchange workers and get them work visas within the Union.
It's noteworthy that the interim agreement enabling the formation of a free trade area between the EAEU and the Islamic Republic was signed 9 days after the Trump administration withdrew from the Iran nuclear agreement in May 2018, and it came into effect on October 27, 2019. The FTA will become permanent within 3 years if pending talks work out. The objectives of the agreement are to liberalize and facilitate the trade of goods between the parties, primarily through reduction or elimination of tariff and non-tariff barriers relating to 502 goods and services by the Eurasian Economic Union and 360 items by Iran. Since 2018, the agreement with the Union has significantly increased Iran's exports to the EAEU and has been a major factor in boosting Iranian non-oil exports during the imposed U.S. sanctions. After the original FTA came into effect, Iran-EAEU trade immediately rose nearly 30% and initially reached $330 million a month.
There are almost complete package of different areas we can have economic exchange with. Most of these countries are very fertile for agricultural products and are rich in water resources. Agricultural products constitute the majority of our imports. We can even do rental farming there, meaning that our farmers can take control of lands there and cultivate their crops. This also provides us with a unique opportunity for the transport sector, because Iran sits on a transit network to Europe on one side and the Far East through Russia, Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan.
The U.S. has changed into a weaker country today. Those who are under the American media's hypnosis need to wake up and act according to their national interests. It's up to us whether or not we are restricted in the regional deals. Why didn't we join the Shanghai Cooperation Organization? There were some who thought that we first need to make deals with the U.S. because it might cause problems for us. We used to remind them that there are only two key nations in the SCO, namely Russia and China, and that making deals with them warrants our permanent membership in the treaty, but they would refuse to wake up from their illusions.
To remove obstacles and further ease the trade process, Iran has stressed the need to abandon the U.S. dollar in settlements and switch to national currencies. The EAEU has repeatedly stated that it is consistently moving towards this goal. Similar statements and practices are presently witnessed in bilateral relations between Iran and some EAEU member states.
The other issue is in national currencies and exchanging them with the other member states of the Eurasian Economic Union. This has already started. Currently, a majority of the financial exchanges that take place between the member states are denominated in their national currency. this creates a good opportunity for the Islamic Republic of Iran to reduce its dependence on the dollar to a great extent. This has also happened too. It's interesting to note that Russia has limited its currency's dependence on the dollar by some 50%, meaning that about 49% of its currency is dependent on the dollar.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
There's plenty more on rapprochement between Iran and the EAEU right after a quick diversion into world media.
Hello and welcome to the news part of the program with me, Sarah Adema. Today we will get into different media outlets to check out some reviews about the prospects of trade with Eurasian countries. Our first review from Newsweek is about a recent poll that shows Iranians losing faith in Biden and the West have hope for Raisi and the East. Most Iranians view U.S. President Joe Biden's policies toward their nation as being rooted in hostility, while majorities also had hope that their new political leader, President Ebrahim Raisi, would fulfill come through with key campaign promises, according to a recent poll. With this came a broader geopolitical shift of support away from the West and looking toward the East. The survey conducted by the University of Maryland Center for International and Security Studies at Maryland in conjunction with the independent Toronto-based Iran Poll asked 1,001 Iranians their views on a range of subjects. As to rate Biden's policies, rated from a 0 of completely hostile to a 10 of completely friendly, 67% of respondents provided a score in the 7 to 4 range, more than half of which, 33.5%, chose 0. The second most popular answer was 5, neither friendly nor hostile, with 26.1%, while all scores above this were minimal. A majority of 44.1% that Iran should try more to strengthen its relations with Asian countries such as Russia, China, and India, and 39.1% saying the same for European countries like Germany, France, and the United Kingdom. We have another review here from Modern Diplomacy that reads, "The Emerging Eastern Axis and the Future of JCPOA." Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh recently said that Tehran would further strengthen its ties with Moscow via strategic partnership. Said Khatibzadeh, the initial arrangements of this document, entitled the Global Agreement for Cooperation between Iran and Russia, have been concluded. This agreement will be similar in nature to the agreement signed by Iran with China in March 2021, dubbed as the Strategic Cooperation Pact, which sought to enhance economic and strategic relations. China would invest $400 billion in infrastructure and oil and gas sector while also strengthening security ties. Commenting on the same, Khatibzadeh also said that an eastern axis is emerging between Russia, Iran, and China. Closer ties with Russia are important from an economic strategic point of view and also to reduce Iran's dependence upon China. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, on the eve of his Russia visit from October 5th to 6th, 2021, also stated that Iran, while strengthening ties, would not be excessively dependent upon either country. Our last review of the day comes from Tehran Times that writes, Iran and Kazakhstan aiming for $6 billion in annual trade. Iranian capital Tehran hosted an Iran-Kazakhstan business forum in October 2021, during which the two sides stressed the need for removing visa issuance and transportation obstacles to realize a $6 billion annual trade target. The business forum was attended by senior officials from both sides, including the head of Iran Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines and Agriculture, Olam Hossein Shafi'i, and Khairat Turabayev, Kazakhstan's Vice Minister of Trade and Integration. Speaking in the meeting, Shafi'i underlined the two countries' common cultural and religious backgrounds and said, Our relations with neighboring countries have a special priority for the government, and Kazakhstan, as one of the largest countries in Central Asia, has an important place for us in Iran's foreign policy. That's it for me in today's edition. Bye-bye.
The idea of rapprochement between Iran and the EAEU has to be considered in the context of Iran's broader persuasive efforts towards greater regionalism and Eurasian cooperation. Tehran's activities with two other regional bodies, the Economic Cooperation Organization, ECO, and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, is indicative of what lies ahead with the EAEU. Tehran's SCO pivot has been consistent with its long-standing balancing acts against Washington, and its outreach to the EAEU reflects the same mindset.
In the current situation, when we are under sanctions, I think one of the best strategies is that while we are continuing negotiations with the West and sitting at the negotiation table, as we are not afraid of dialogue based on the principles of the Islamic Republic and the revolution, the 13th administration must also have a special look to the East. And certainly if we can gain membership in the international treaties with regional unions in the East, like Eurasia, ASEAN, and etc., we can actually increase our power in the region. And that in itself has a deterrent power over the West.
Iranian policymakers are confident that the dependence of Iran and EAEU countries on trade with each other brings additional regional security in the process.
The Eurasian Economic Union is an economic arm that strengthens its member states. We don't consider it a mere economic pact. When it comes to improving the standards of members, there is also the issue of security. We have the northwest of Iran, both the northern and southern Caucasus, which is a strategic region where the American and Western sides have always wanted to incite sedition. They're now using Turkey as a tool to disrupt the region under various pretexts. Turkey is also a member of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Eastern nations, by forging security alliances, seek to stand against the Western parties that want to disrupt the peace in the region.
Judging by what both Iran and the EAEU member states say, all the sides are intent on replacing the interim agreement with a permanent one. Iran, with its large population, is viewed as a strong economic power. In terms of nominal GDP, its economy ranks 22nd globally. Iran is also endowed with 9.5% of the world's total oil reserves and ranks fourth in the world in this category. According to data released recently by Iran's Customs Administration, IRICA, the value of non-oil trade between Iran and the members of the EAEU exceeded $1.6 billion in the first 4 months of the current Iranian calendar year, that's March 21st to July the 22nd, to register 93% year-on-year growth compared to 2020. In total, Iran exported over $385 million worth of commodities to the EAEU countries during that period, which accounts for an increase of 46%. This is while Iran's import from the EAEU reached $1.25 billion in the same period. Moreover, according to data published by the EAEU's executive body so far, nearly half of Iran's exports have gone to Russia, 40% to Armenia, and 10% to Kazakhstan. These export items include fruits, vegetables, nuts, cement, ferrous metal products, petroleum products, and natural or liquefied gas. On the other end, nearly three